This is Sophie, and you're listening to the Jew and the Gentile podcast.
And now for something completely different.
And or meet me for cigars sometime this weekend, but whatever.
Right.
Oh, that could happen. That'll
kill you.
Right. Yeah, but it's only going to kill the weak brain cells and lung cells.
Like survival of the fittest for brain cells. Mm-hmm. Like it's the slowest and oldest brain cells are the ones that die off first.
Right, so it keeps you like sharper and brighter.
Mm-hmm. I'm just terrifying the herd.
No, yeah,
you
seriously.
Thinning.
I'm picking up tobacco for Lent, so we should do cigars this weekend.
There's a lot of words I'd use to describe you, Chris, but thinning isn't one of them.
Never.
Oh.
I'm working to be big enough to be considered the 101st county in North Carolina is what I'm really working on. So I'm carrying a lot of holiday weight from like 42
every,
years.
Every off. Holiday?
And every Saints feast day.
Yeah, you're lucky yeah. you're not Jewish. You'd be like 900 pounds.
Yeah, yeah. We only fast twice a year, so, you know.
Well, yeah, but you have a holiday. Like, sometimes there's not enough days. There's like two in one day. It's hard to keep track.
Yeah. Well, and they're all around food.
What's the one where you just get fucked up till you just don't have any sense?
Purim.
God. Yes. We had,
it was Purim every night in my house growing up.
Yeah.
We call it Purim, though.
Yeah.
There's usually less punching in a Purim.
Right. Yeah. Yes, right. Right. It was Purim every night in your house, and everybody was Haman. So. And you're the one that's complaining that I turned the record button on too soon.
Well, usually it's just us doing just mindless or boring kind of, you know, what are we going to talk about? What? Anyway.
But you never know.
How is that different than the normal show?
That's what I was saying. Exactly.
That's not really.
Yeah. So, talking about normal show, welcome to the normal show.
I'm Charles Breton.
And I'm Chris Henson. And together we are
a Jew
and a Gentile
walk into a bar
mitzvah.
Wishing I could change the things that I screwed up. What am I supposed to do? I can't give up.
Jew and a Gentile walking to a bar, midst for the podcast, episode 88. Charles Breton, the Jew, with me as always is Chris Henson, our Gentile, and the ampersand of reason, our special permanent guest host, the Reverend Helena Epstein. We're also joined for this episode by Andrew Males, who is, among other things, a friend of the show. Second-time guest and director at Wesley Luther Campus Ministries at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and all-around good guy, but we like him anyway. And we don't believe anything anybody says about him. We like him anyway.
Right.
So welcome to the podcast where you'll find theology, cigars, whiskey, and F-bombs, and our new tagline, courtesy of the Rev Helena, we don't make sense, but we're coherent.
I forgot I said that.
Yeah. Well, you're the ampersand of reason.
For a good
reason. Before we get into our topic for this episode, do want to acknowledge your sponsors. As always, start with Men of the Beard Oil. Best Christian shaman we know. And some mighty fine beard oil. Virgil Kane.
Well, you got to plug his website now. He's got
right. Yes. Was it Shamanar or Pastornar.com?
I feel like we should know that.
We should know that. We'll check on that.
Sorry, Nar.
Yeah. Virgil Kane Rye, the official rye whiskey of our podcast.
And why was the sample not brought to me?
Actually, that's a good question.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because they're not selling it anymore in North Carolina, or they're discontinuing selling in North Carolina.
No, just the Roundhouse are discontinuing. And
okay.
And possibly the ginger. But I believe the Robber Baron Rye is still going to be available. It better be. Otherwise, we're organizing road trips to South Carolina.
That's how good Virgil Kane's liquor is.
Yes.
We would go to South Carolina. Well, we'd have to we'd go do that. We'd buy fireworks and just make a whole day of it, really.
Yeah.
You'll be excited to know Chris, that I'm in a room here with a hardwood floors and a very active labradoodle. So
I was waiting for that. It's either it's somebody's dog other than Charles. He didn't have one. Usually interrupts the podcast at some point.
Yeah, it's you're not going to hear barking, but there'll be quite a bit of clickety clacking. I'm going to bet. Mm.
Don't worry, eating vegetable chips will drown that out. So,
oh yeah, let me go ahead here and just these vegetable crisps are delicious.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they don't sponsor us.
Oh yeah, that's good stuff.
We can't mention them. But sure, if we had some Virgil Caine or some good Four Saints beer to Four Saints brew with.
Yeah. Oh, it would be delicious.
Would be delicious.
Sweet and salty. Yeah, that would go very well.
Yeah.
Four Saints Brewery there in Asheboro, North Carolina.
Asheboro. Also where we host our Drinking Religiously Taproom Theology, the second Tuesday of every month.
Sunday of every month. It's Beer and Hymns.
Beer and Hymns, yes.
Oh, that's this Sunday.
Yes, this Sunday will be Beer and Hymns. That's right.
Come for the singing and then the abstinence.
Yes. Mm. But also it's Father Joe's, it was Father Joe's birthday yesterday. And that's his wife who does Beer and Hymns. And it's Father Joe who's part of our Drinking Religiously. So you can come and wish him happy birthday.
There we go.
Okay. We're also sponsored by the Pipe and Pint, where I was earlier this week picking up the cigar I'm smoking. The best humidor in the triad. And apparently they're getting closer to opening in Winston-Salem, but they are still their main location in Greensboro. And yes, Chris, it is on Spring Garden.
I know. I'm still waiting for the one in Winston. I used to get excited anymore.
Yeah. That's because you guys get Larry.
My whole life is disappointed. I can take Larry. At least he can see over the counter.
Yeah. And finally, but not last.
Because Pete's not the kind of guy you look up to.
No, not really.
Nobody looks up to Pete because he's short. But anyway,
put on foam. And then also Top Leaf Cigar Lounge, speaking of Winston-Salem, the premier cigar lounge in the triad.
They have grown their stock. Oh, my gosh. Their
stock, and they've got some wonderful product. They've got some of the usual suspects, but they've got some really good of the craft
Boutique brands.
And
they've got some of your more familiar, larger brands, too.
Yeah. No, I'm saying they have some of the usual suspects, but they also have these wonderful boutiques that you don't usually find. It's very good stuff. So, Chris, you want to lie and tell us what you're smoking?
Oh, I smoked it this past weekend with Helena. So, there's that.
Yeah.
I broke. This is an out of character one, in a sense, because I don't usually smoke this brand, at least not the... this version of it, but the Patagas Black Label.
Okay.
That's one at Top Leaf, and I'm...
Now, you have to differentiate that the Patagas Black Label is different than the Patagas Black.
It's the Black Label.
Right. Yeah, but those are two different
cigars. But it's an Oscuro wrapper, so it looks like... It's just all dark and oily.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 6x54 ring gauge from General Cigar Dominicana. And I purchased it at Top Leaf Cigar Lounge here in Winston-Salem. The wrapper is Connecticut Medio Tempo Maduro, but it looks way darker than that. Binder's Dominican, the filler's Nicaraguan and Dominican. Tasting notes, it's sweet and savory. There are blasts of spice, black pepper, earth, wood, black licorice, and there's actually some creamy notes in it. But this is not a start-of-the-day cigar.
Oh, no.
This is a I'm-done-for-the-fucking-week cigar. The reviews I read online were saying, like, this is a medium-bodied cigar. Only if Stacy was doing the review or Pete was doing the review would this be a medium-bodied cigar. It was full-on just wow. Mm-hmm. But really good, really sweet. Trying to think what I'd compare it to and just lost my train of thought on that because it was just that good. So there.
Hey, okay. Helena, you're up.
So I don't have all the details about size and whatnot and wrapper, but I have...
Well, you're a woman, so size doesn't matter.
Damn it. Eat a chip.
I had the My Father Opulencia.
She did.
I did.
Wow.
It was very good. So, honestly, like the first third of it was super spicy and kind of sweet. I really liked it. Then it mellowed out into kind of a earthy cocoa flavor for the rest of it. It was like super spicy, peppery, not peppery, like, I can't think of what it was. It wasn't peppery, but it was spicy. And then it got into this kind of warm, rich cocoa flavor. And then the last third was kind of earthy. It was really a beautiful cigar. It was very good.
It was her first, My Father.
It was. Wow.
And I think that was the number two or three cigar this year.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. And that's a very typical profile from a My Father, is that,
yeah,
that pepper bomb up front. That this,
oh my gosh! Yes. I wanted that to be the whole cigar. I would have been happy if like the whole thing had been that peppery.
Oh, well, they do that.
They do that too. Yeah.
Well, so I'll have to find those for next time.
Mm-hmm.
Super peppery.
Well, Pipe and Pint happens to be a My Father Lounge.
That's right.
Yes. Oh, exclusive.
Yes.
It's a My Father Lounge without a lounge, but they have all the
correct. But they have almost all their facings.
They have blends that like they were only made for that shop.
Oh.
So it's,
when
it's,
they come to Winston, I'll have to check it out.
Definitely. So speaking of Pipe and Pint, that's where I went to get the cigar I'm smoking now. It's the Viaje Honey and Hand Grenade.
And yeah, we had those this past weekend.
That's so wonderful. You're like, we had that.
Top leaf.
I
had a deal.
Gee, yeah. Thanks. Okay. Just
four pack.
I was like, cigar choice here.
Yeah, you got to get close to the mic, Helene, if you're going to make that comment.
What comment? The telling you to lick your lips?
Yes.
And he looked at me
yelling that across the cigar lounge. Lick your lips!
He was like, the fuck? And I was like, dude, just do it. It was amazing. Anyways.
The sad thing was I did it.
You guys want to do the review of the Honey and Hand Grenade?
No, you go ahead.
Thank you. Anyway, this was a blend that they came out with in 2012, and by 2016, they were gone. So they haven't had them since 2016. And they've reproduced the blend almost exactly. So it's almost the same profile from the 2012. It's a Nicaraguan Criollo wrapper, Nicaraguan binder and filler, including Aganorsa. And it, like the name suggests, even though the hand grenade part isn't in the body, because it's a pretty medium cigar, but you start with some nice pepper and spiciness, and then a little woody, almost like an oak, more oak than cedar that you'd normally get with cigars. And when the sweetness starts, and I was reading Cigar Coop and his review, and he had the same similar thought that I had, is before you're trying to figure out what is this sweetness. It's you would kind of expect it to be like honey because it's called Honey and Hand Grenade, but it's not. But eventually it just morphs into just the natural sweetness that you get from tobacco. And it's Andres Farkas in his blending has really just brought that out, that people don't realize the complexity of tobacco and that nice sweetness that you get. And that's very prominent in this cigar. So it is quite quite savory and delicious, and it is both honey and hand grenade in that. So there.
We learned from Bethany that it was... that the red wrapper on the front end of the cigar is supposed to mimic blood, mm-hmm. and they're named, the different sizes and vitolas are named after things like shanks and shivs.
Yes, I have the shiv, which is the 6.5 by 50.
So,
yep. Also, the honey and hand grenade, and the symbolism is also supposed to come from some Hindi or Urdu thing, but I couldn't track that down. I've heard that rumor as well. Well, we're going to get to our top story tonight. Getting to our main topic, it's been a tumultuous week for the third oldest denomination of Christianity in the United States. Two of our panelists tonight are members of that church, at least for now. we will see what happens after that. Of course, we're talking about the General Council of the United Methodist Church in St. Louis this past week, and the several plans, particularly the traditional and the one church plan, that were put forward. And I'm just going to turn it to you, Chris, to get started if you want to vent or background. This is amazing. It's sad. It's frustrating. I mean, just watching it from the outside, I'm really feeling for the not just the people I know who are in this church and have, like you, grown up in that church, but even those I don't know, this is cannot be an easy time.
No, so it's General Conference, which is sort of the highest ranking body of decision makers, called a special session for, was held in St. Louis over the course of last weekend and earlier this week. And it was to consider our Book of Discipline, which is sort of like our clergy rules and church rules, how they were going to handle issues of gender identity and homosexuality, same-sex marriage, a whole number of things. And I actually rather kick this to Andrew because he's probably got a more succinct presentation of it. So I'm tagging out vegetable chips.
Yeah, there's not there. I don't think there's very much way to be succinct about it because it was right. A messy process to begin with.
Well, I was going to say, I could be very succinct from what I've read. Succinctly put, they fucked this up.
Yeah, that's probably a pretty accurate.
So if you want to expand on that, Andrew.
So we've had a lot of shifts inside the church. One of those shifts is a growing worldwide population, which is great, except that a lot of those areas, Africa, Philippines, and this is not a universal statement, but most of those areas tend to be more conservative, more fundamentalist. And as that portion of the church has grown, and that coupled with some areas of the church, you might be surprised to learn, largely in the South.
No.
Yeah,
Jesus.
Are on a more conservative end of the church. So, well, I think about 2/3 of the American delegates had really been fighting for what was called the One Church Plan. Which was
Council of Bishops. That's what they came for.
Yeah, yeah, and the Council of Bishops by a pretty overwhelming majority, which is impressive because if you can get bishops to agree on something, that's. But so they rejected the One Church Plan, which was kind of a plan that allowed everyone at different levels to do what was of their conscience. So it would not force anyone who did not want to perform same-sex weddings, wouldn't force conferences to ordain gay, lesbian, LGBTQ members, but it would allow what is the reality to already to acknowledge that the church has varied stance, and there's already gay and lesbian clergy, there's already weddings going on, and the majority of the American church just doesn't believe anymore really that the Bible prohibits gay relationships.
Meanwhile, the Central Conference says, hold my beer.
Yes, but when you couple the more conservatives in the United States and the Central Conference, and mind you...
So Central Conferences are the foreign conferences.
Yeah.
And still related to Methodism.
And mind you, they've been cultivating this a lot, right?
Oh,
they've
yeah.
been sending free phones and all sorts of things from the Wesleyan Covenant and Good News has really been courting them to make sure that they were on that side of the issue.
Right.
What that really means is about 53, somewhere between like 53 and 56% of the vote rejected the One Church Plan and went for the conservative plan, which was pretty much the let's take our kind of current language, which is brutal and rejects gay and lesbians and wounds them.
And let's double down on it.
Let's turbocharge it. Yeah, let's see if we can firm up that language, and then can we put some mandatory, so there's 17 petitions in the plan that are meant to enforce mandatory punishments, firm up a lot of language. They wanted to create a group that would oversee bishops so that bishops couldn't sort of be forgiving or not punishing behavior like performing same-sex unions. And they voted, they affirmed that plan, despite the fact that apparently they
didn't affirm it by much.
Yeah, they didn't affirm it by much. Yeah. It barely passed. But it also, in parts, was written by, I'm going to be charitable and say, like, a 4.5-year-old. There were some massive problems. And before they even voted on it, big swaths of it had been declared unconstitutional by our equivalent of the Supreme Court, the Judicial Council. Had already said this is unconstitutional. So I think at least 7 and part of one more, and it might be, I think there's a sentence in one more and maybe another one that they'll rule on in April, and whole sections of this thing are going to be declared unconstitutional. So what they've really delivered is just this
steamy
mess.
Pile of shit.
It's not going to do what they want it to do. It's not going to accomplish what they want it to accomplish. So you're probably going to have people on the more conservative end leaving the church. But they also managed, in the midst of bumbling this process and doing this thing, to just be really as wounding and as terrible to our LGBTQ family inside and outside the church as really possible.
That's what I was about to say.
I mean, at least in my decision, they would say that they're being loving, but I don't.
My dad said that a lot of times.
Right.
Beat the shit out of me, so kind of feels that way.
So we have of course, a pretty good idea of what this treatment does to internalized homophobia and just overall mental health. I deal with this on a day-to-day basis.
Well, that's why
basis.
I wanted you on here, is that, you know, tell me a little bit about Wheeloo, just kind of a background. You're on the front line more so than I am.
Yeah. The program I run, Wesley Luther, was the first reconciling campus ministry in the Carolinas, which means it's a ministry that's open to, I mean, really everyone, regardless of race, ability, sexual orientation, gender identity. It's open and fully welcoming, and celebrates all of those people, you know, radical idea. Like, wow, you know, all, when you say all are welcome, like you'd actually mean it. Crazy thing. So long Harrison. Before I came, I've been there about 10 years. Wesley Luther was already a really, it had reconciled, and Ron Moss, who had been the campus minister there for a long time, it was really a student led move, but Ron had really helped that come to fruition. It also, incidentally, was the campus ministry, one of the conference organizations that the Good News Movement and conservative elements of the church, way back when, I think it was 2006, which was before, a little bit before my time, they actually, we had a decision that went to the Judicial Council about whether we could be receive funding from the conference or not, because we were open to gay and lesbian students. So they didn't think we should be able to get funding from the conference, which wrong about, right. It turned out. So we try to do a lot. We have a large, UNCG has a very large outpopulation. It's a very diverse campus. It's a majority-minority campus. It's the most diverse in the system. So we really work with a pretty diverse population. So I get to see, I have the benefit of watching, of being able to really see on a day-to-day basis, just the absolute destruction that these points of view reap through the lives of young people as they sort of internalize that they can't really fully see themselves or develop, and really destroys if you can't really hold yourself right up to the reflection of the divine and acknowledge and come to settle on yourself for all your warts and all of those things and find that reflection, I'm not really sure how you see it in the world. So a lot of people that are wounded at a very fundamental level. The rate of suicide among LGBTQ youth is much higher, and that's largely because of they are, one, not accepted in their families, and mainly their families have that point of view because of their churches, and they're also not accepted in their churches. So two grounding places for identity and development that really have robbed from them. And then on top of that, it's not just a neutral that's taken away from them, but actually they consistently hear messages from it that somehow this thing that's deeply a part of their identity and deeply a part of their the expression of themselves in the world is evil, you know, is evil, is terrible, is an abomination before God. And that does some considerable damage.
Yeah.
If you don't mind, and of course, keeping privacy and confidentiality and things like that, how are things on the campus? How have they been the last couple of days? You know, what has been the reaction there on your campus?
I think that's still settling in. It's going to take some time to see. I mean, there's a lot of students who are confused or don't really get it. Just the idea that the church would be this backwards, I think, even if it existed before, but kind of reaffirming and doubling down. It's one thing if it's just sort of been a part of your tradition and they haven't been able to overcome it. But this is just like a huge step, right, backwards. This is like we're going to turn the cart back to the 1950s.
It was a slug in the chest because I figured that my gut was saying, like all Methodist things, they'll kick it down the road. I thought that was the worst that would happen is they'll kick it to the actual full session of General Conference a few years. And I thought, well, if that doesn't work, they'll go centrist to moderate. But when I saw, not only did they do the traditional plan, but they was like, let's try to make this as hateful and ugly as we can fucking possibly do it. Mm-hmm. And I felt the rage for my LGBTQ brothers and sisters. I felt a lot of anger towards the Central Conference nations, which don't exactly have the best human rights records, weighing in on shit that really doesn't affect their country. And I mean, my initial reaction, and you kind of hear the emotion in my voice, was, great, you guys keep your homophobia, we'll keep our humanitarian aid. And I know that's not Christ-like, but that's where I was at earlier this week.
Yeah.
And knowing folks that are in that good noobs movement that, man, you guys are just dead to me. You're torturing people you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, so sure. On campus, it's bad. It ranges from confusion to really deep hurt. I have former students in seminary that this just really tears at them. Really makes them question their call. I have young people whose parents are involved in churches. They're wondering what's going to happen to their church, or if their parents are in appointments. They're wondering what this is going to mean for them. My gay and lesbian United Methodist students are, you know, wondering how is this going to affect my ability long term to consider being in leadership, or is this a trend in the church that even if it doesn't just stop here, do we extend it to missionaries, or do we extend it? It's a whole lot of certainty, and it just sucks. It really sucks.
Yeah.
Oh, and one of my reactions is also earlier this week, and I still kind of feels like good luck enforcing it. I mean, I really do think that there'll be, I had to at least mentally see it as an unfortunate is not a strong enough word, and setbacks even less, but it doesn't mean that we stop just because of this conference.
So
I was thinking, like, this is super intellectual and not related to the emotional components of this necessarily, but I've been thinking about it this week. I know the ELCA and the Episcopal Church both had splits occur when they chose to err on the side of support for LGBTQ individuals. And I've seen grumblings in the Methodist community about splitting because of this decision, but to form a church that is inclusive. And I wonder, like, if what thoughts you guys have about that as Methodists, like, is that just backlash and wounding? Right. Like, there's been splits also, because of the other direction, but what would it mean for a split to occur because of a lack of affirmation?
Well, when I was reading through the traditional plan and the one church plan, and one of the more nefarious things, besides just the hurtful language in which they wanted to not just say, oh yeah, this is in our book of discipline, but we're reaffirming it, we're really focused on it, is how they said, and if you don't like it, here's your escape plan. We'll give you back your property. If you're a conference, we'll give you $200,000. Don't let the empty pew hit your ass on the way out. And it's setting up not what could be a split, but almost a splintering.
Again, their intention is to purge.
Right, exactly. And I think it needs to be noted that it was not by accident that the opposing plan was called a one church plan.
Right.
Because it's not just, it's this issue. Was it came up with it's the also, it was also, you know, and if you don't like this, then just get the hell out.
Yeah.
And the way it's written, it's very rude.
Yeah. I mean, it was intention. Its intention mm-hmm. was not to create a place where people could choose to stay if they wanted to, but really to define it in a way that would force a whole section of people that they don't want to be in the church out. That's what it was designed to do.
Okay. Yeah.
That's what it feels like. That's why it's so hurtful. It's a group of people in power deciding that they can use that power to just step on the little guy already. If you haven't done enough, you know, you might as well really put your foot on the throat of the person that's much smaller than you, that you've already shoved to the ground, if they're going to be squeaky and, you know, fight for their own right to be in the long, just go ahead and finish it. Yeah. There isn't a real good way, I think to spin what happened. I mean,
just theologically so abhorrent. Like it just, especially for a Wesleyan tradition that focuses on, I think about the inclusion at the table of even like baptized people. That's really radical for a mainline Christian denomination, but to not have that kind of expand into a deeper understanding of what the love and expression of Christ's being on earth really means is just mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, and just from the historical note, I mean, that was one of the issues that caused them to break off from the Anglican and then eventually Episcopal, you know, among other things, but that was one of those issues was, you know, who is welcome at the Lord's table.
Right.
And Wesley and you know, his followers wanting that to be defined a little bit more inclusively than was happening in the Anglican church at the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. We say a big tent, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a diverse liturgical tradition. There are like many, there are many things that, right. It's not a confessional church. There aren't a whole lot of things that unite it. We're united in practice, right? In the things that we do and how we go out and do service and engage in our community, how we bring the fruition through the labor of our hands and the love of our hearts, how we use our hands to bring Christ's kingdom to reality, right? It's through the creation of holiness, the making of disciples for the transformation of the world. That is the United Methodist thing. And I mean, there's people disagree about how communion becomes communion, right? Not like a really like solid agreement across it. There are low church and high church. There's people that come out of, you know, the Anglican sort of end of things. And then you have people that the Phoebe Palmer, like sort of holiness, the Pentecostal break off, you know, that end, it's all been held together. Historically, we are a people who hold diverse points of view about lots of things, but the thing that unites us is the toleration of those diverse points of view, being able to fully be a part of that church, right?
Right.
And the problem is that when we talk about, they talk about this sort of the holding, well, you have to make room. What about us who feel really strongly that the Bible prohibits homosexuality and these sort of things, that's not the same as saying we can have a whole point of views that don't include pushing some people out, right? That's the line that doesn't fit. And the other thing that I find frustrating in it is there's a lot of language when we talk back and forth, like it's about like side, oh, it's two points of views. It's, you know, there's hurt. Like I hear a lot of people And I say this lovingly because there's a lot of people I really care about who have said the same thing in like letters and a lot of things about there being hurt on both sides. That is not a fair thing to say.
No.
In that it's a false equivalency. There may be hurt on both sides, but on one side, the hurt is actual, right? It is actual exclusion. It's actual consequences. It is not just about feeling or feeling hurt or overgoing, right? There is a real hurt on one side. And in the same way that it was to say, like, well, whites in the South are uncomfortable with people of color coming and sitting in the same spaces, so people are hurt on both sides. No, that's not. No. Like one side like is actually excluded, is actually pushed out of really being able to be a full part of the community of grace, and especially marriage, right? Especially the idea that their relationships can't be blessed or acknowledged fully in the church. To me, that is just that's abominable. It's just horrible. It is an abomination.
It is.
It's just not in the way they think. Right.
And it, not only is it real, the other part that makes it false equivalence, and again, you know, when you read the language in both plans, the hurt that was inflicted by, or that is felt by those who are, you know, by the LGBT community, by allies, by people who just feel that this is wrong, is that hurt was intentionally inflicted.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just a byproduct. Oh, by the way, you've hurt me. Mm-hmm. No, that plan, when you read it, it was set out to hurt. And you compare it to the inclusive language in the One Church plan, which was, as Andrew described, just in the history of the United Methodist Church, was, you know, yes, we've always had some things that we all don't always agree on. We need to have a way that these are things that if this affects a local church or if this affects a particular conference, that they should be able to cite it. And, you know, we want to maintain this. And it was about inclusion. And the traditional plan was, no, we want to hurt these people. And if you don't want to hurt, then bye.
Well, this is the same thing.
And if you're going to stay, we're going to punish you.
Well, this has some similarity to the splits over slavery during the Civil War, the MEC South and the MEC, the Methodist Episcopal Church South. Lo and behold, you know, within my lifetime, ordination of women became acceptable. I mean, I don't really understand just the, why do you hate them so much? How does that impact your life in any fucking way? It's not likely that they're going to be in your church, and I hate to use the word they, but I just broad. And part of me wonders, like, well, what happens if the churches take this out and leave? I mean, I think that some of these congregations that really, really are against, are really, really for this traditional plan, don't realize that they're going to hurt themselves in the long run too.
What's frustrating to me is that the double whammy of this is that generally, there are lots of churches that do really great things, but a lot of, as much as we complain about, or I hear people complain, I don't have as much of a complaint about the structure and the bureaucracy, the conference agencies and conference ministries, like the ministries on the fringes of the church, right, that are going out and our missional communities, the campus ministries, the camps, those things, they're working with vulnerable populations. A lot of us are the ones that are working with LGBTQ individuals or individuals that are struggling with addiction, folks that have been hurt in all sorts of ways that typically wouldn't fit into the church quite as well. We'll take a huge part of that hit, right? Because when people leave and 25% of the conference budget goes away, that's the funding of the agencies that are working with these vulnerable folks anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's just like in all directions, there's not a way that this ends well for those of us that are in extension ministries who are trying to work with these vulnerable populations. It's not going to be good for chaplains. It's not going to be good for campus ministries. It's not going to be good for recovery centers and fringe ministries groups that work with veterans. It's going to hurt those more than anything.
Mm-hmm. So Chris, you had shared some words that were recently spoken, and I think this would be a good time if you want to read the statement from Reverend Dr. Samuel Wells.
Reverend Dr. Samuel Wells was one time Dean of Duke Chapel, or Duke University, and research professor of Christian ethics. And he's now the vicar at St. Martin's in the Fields, London. And this was a sermon that he preached apparently today at Duke Chapel, which is the, Goodson Chapel, sorry, which is the chapel inside the Divinity School. And I'll read his somewhat lengthy quote, but I think very, very thought-provoking and very healing in a sense. To those who spent the last two or three days in a mixture of hurt and horror and shame, I've just got this to say. From the time that Peter saw the sacred canopy, Christians have always known that what we've always been taught and what God is saying today aren't always exactly the same thing. And from the time when the vote and the praetorium went for Barabbas and not for Jesus, we've always known that votes in democracy were flawed ways of making decisions. And from the time when the women went to the tomb early on the first day of the week, we've always known that the road to resurrection lay only through the cross.
I'm going to go into my teacher mode. What in particular struck you when you read that? And the open question to the three of you. Deep thought going on.
Yeah, I always think it's just a reminder that the capacity for the church to help and heal is overwhelming, but the capacity for the church to really inflict terrible harm is just as much power, right? It can wield its power in all sorts of directions. And the church is not immune to mob rule, right? To making really big mistakes that really, really do cause harm. And we need to acknowledge that and be careful. I mean, move slower. It is...
I don't know what my reaction is. There's part of me that wants to say, like, all right, you guys can have the Titanic. Enjoy being on the bridge. You've earned the right to watch this ship sink. May you drown with it. But there's another part of me that says, you know, leaving is exactly what you sons of bitches want me to do. And if I can't have an inclusive church, I'll make it really hard for you to have an exclusive one.
Really struck by this idea that votes and democracy are flawed ways of making decisions. I think especially as Americans, we tend to see, we idealize democracy as the best way of making decisions. But in this case, obviously, it was a decision that really didn't reflect well on the kingdom and glory of God in the world. So how you move forward as the body of Christ without getting overly attached to a specific way of operating within that body, right? How do you separate the structures and power from the actual expression of God's love on the world that is the church? As someone who's not Methodist, I've been pondering a lot this week about how to, in what ways do I have an opportunity to reflect God's love to those people who've been wounded in this week by a body that they hold dear, that they have a sense of connection and have found sacredness within. So it struck me.
Mm-hmm. Me, it just feels like I'm betrayed and I'm just like trying to find reasons and remember incidences where the experience of the congregational church has been positive for me. And I'm really struggling to find a whole lot of things to focus on. Mm-hmm. And that's being charitable even before what occurred this week occurred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's going to be interesting to see how this continues to play out in the coming weeks and months. And Chris, you alluded to this, a big discussion on social media has been, you know, how do you make the decision of, okay, do you give up and walk away and say, all right, we're no longer going to be a part of this, or do you stay and try to make change from inside? And that's going to be a very interesting dialogue that a lot of people, a lot of churches, a lot of conferences are going to be having.
Well, and is the best way to have what is? I'm trying to even think of this from a chaplain point of view, or at least the, you know, the Wesleyan sort of a belief of do no harm. Is it worth fighting for an institution versus starting new, mm-hmm. realizing that the Holy Spirit moves and it's not going to be locked behind doors of homophobia and transphobia. You can add any other racism, sexism. Keep going.
Right.
Let them have their lockbox, but decide to follow the Spirit out into the world and connect and embrace and live that sort of call. You know, and I was thinking while Andrew was talking earlier that the Matthew 25, and I just, you know, the preacher in me is kind of like, well, Lord, when did we see you transgender? When did we see you gay? When did we see you lesbian? When did we see you bisexual? When did we see you genderqueer? it's not really that far of a step from when you did it under the least of these. Yeah, and it does hit home when you grew up in the denomination, your family, your in-laws. I mean, it's just a different thing altogether. I'm embarrassed at the least, ashamed at the most, and just, you know, I don't cherish my ordination in the way I did earlier before this week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I feel that it's almost part of the problem.
I think, though, that for me, I still see a draw from a lot of, I have students, right? I see these amazing young adults.
Yes.
That are mm-hmm. far better people than me, with more capacity to love, I think better reflections of God than I am. Many of them are gay and lesbian, and they are people who just awe me in what they have overcome, what they are capable of doing, how they care for each other, how they rebound from mistakes, their patience, their just ability for goodness. And they desire to be a part of this church. And I'm willing to fight as long as I can fight to do everything I can to make that a possibility. Because I will say that the church as its best is, you know, like a marriage at its best. It's something that's greater than the sum of its parts. It is a movement that can come together and change things. And yes, like sometimes new things grow because a fire burns so hot that it destroys everything and only ash is left. But more commonly, it just burns off some of the underbrush or singes some of the things away. And parts of the old life and the trees are intermixed with new life and growth. And the forest and the garden look different, but they still have some of what was old and some of what was new. They span, you know, across times and all of those things, right? Isn't that the mystery of communion? Like the church at its best holds what was, what is, and what is to come. And, you know, they still feel that, right? They're still tied in that communion, that connection means something. And that's despite the fact that they are treated like crap, right, by that mm-hmm. denomination, that they are wounded, that they're seeing their friends wounded, all of those things, but it's a home to them or something that they're coming to that's valuable. And I can't promise that I can fight forever, but as long as I have the energy and will in me, I will continue to fight to make that place so that they have the same opportunities that I did.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do. Yeah. I love this church. You know, like I loved alcoholics and all sorts of people, you know, that I've had connections with all the time, that there are parts that are bad, but there's also in it, I've seen a capacity for creation and goodness that I'm not willing to give up on yet. Now, of course, I haven't lived it my whole life. I'm a Methodist by choice. I came from the ELCA over to Methodism 10 years ago. Now I work for both churches. Imagine that. Convenient.
Yeah. I'm cradle. Yeah. You know, but it's, you know, I think my attitude right now is I was baptized, I was confirmed, I was ordained, and I did not become ordained because of polity or your book of discipline. No. I was moved by Wesley's spirit for the poor, for those on the outcast, because that's where I kind of grew up. And that made sense to me. Mm-hmm. And now I haven't experienced it as anybody LGBT or Q, but I know what it's like to be the poor kid at church when the church is wealthy. And so there's a part of me that's really stings because this hits home, and I can, at some level, even only at an infinitesimal level, understand what that burn and that pain has got to feel like. And I don't know. That's the honest answer I can give tonight.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is not a good time. I would not highly recommend being queer and a member of the Methodist communion right now. Mm-hmm. Feeling wonderful, it does not.
Well, maybe that's a response, is to protect vulnerable persons and find them communities where they don't have to feel unsafe. But then, and I say that, and I know as being a pastor, that LGBTQ people are not this sort of urban phenomenon. They're in rural churches, they're in backwards churches, they're in conservative churches, they're in small churches, they're in big churches.
Some of them are ordained.
Many of them.
Ooh.
Scandalous. Oh.
Yeah.
The gays are among us. Yeah.
Well, I want to start, I think, wrapping a bit. We can certainly continue this discussion, and we'll probably will revisit this, because as we've noted, this is
have we broken the rules yet, Andrew, to like where I could be defrocked? I'm just saying, like, if not, we should just go.
You mean like
broke.
On the podcast, or
right? Well, yeah, if we do all 88 episodes, yeah. I'm sure I'm fucked.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean,
no,
but that's the thing, though. Our church is supposed to be able to contain various points of views, people that like disagree heartily with big issues and huge parts, which anyone that's in a portion of the church that has been through the hell of mental health issues and how badly the church deals with those, or is gay or lesbian or is a person of color or any of those things, knows that. But we're supposed to be able to make our discipline work in a way that includes everyone fully in God's grace. That is the line that holds us as a church, and that's the one that was transgressed in this. And that's what's got to be fixed. So you're probably going to have to work harder if you want to get kicked out, Chris.
Well, they can have my ordination when they come pried away from my cold, dead hands.
Aww. 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 Well, what I'd like to do is, of course, thank our guest, Andrew Mells, for sharing his perspective. And before we get to words of wisdom, though, you've kind of hit it a few times, but just give you the last word on this. And
To our
words of wisdom.
I was actually thinking, and I don't know, and I know this puts you on the spot, Charles.
Yeah.
I guess Helena, too. I'm wondering if there is something, the other side of this interfaith relationship, that could be spoken, like a prayer. I don't know. It didn't even have to be in English, just to kind of solemnly
recognize
what's happened this week.
Well, the only thing that comes to mind, the first thing that comes to mind is, a prayer for healing, and I reach for my handy
Jewish scout book.
Yeah, my scout book, Sidur Sim Shalom. No, the particular prayer for healing, our God and God of our ancestors, God of healing and of love, please bring healing of body and mind and spirit and soul to all who are inflicted and who suffer. That I think is what's needed at this point. I share that prayer of healing for all members of the UMC family, particularly those who are LGBTQ trans members of that community, those who find themselves in allyship with them, and to those who like Andrew, want to continue that fight. And so may God give them the strength, the courage, the endurance, physical and spiritual, to carry that on and to move past the hurt and still continue to be doing God's work in repairing the world and bringing holiness to all the dark places on the earth.
Okay. Well, let us realize the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King Jr.
I said, I want to give Andrew last word on this as our guest.
Yeah, I think for me, it's just to say, I hope that every person who is a member of this community or is in their family or is as a friend or is in a community, a queer person of color, a person who has multiple ways that society tells them they don't belong on a regular basis, to tell them that you are seen, you are heard, you are loved, and you are valued. Mm. You are precious in God's sight. You are precious in my sight. You matter to this world,
right?
And to a host of people. And our churches and our world needs you and the light that you bring to it. And that I know this is a painful time, and this will not be the only painful time. There'll be times to come. There'll be things that are done in this world by people in power, intentionally and unintentionally, but that is not a reflection of how infinitely valuable you are, how perfectly you were created, how much you matter in the arc of the universe, that you are a true gift to this world and to each other. And if no one else ever says that to you, then let me shout it and sing it and love it into this world. And I will not be the last person that says it, because it is absolutely true. And if anyone has led you to believe otherwise, I am so sorry. And I apologize on behalf of everyone in all of our communities of faith if they have ever made you feel that way. And I promise we will try to do better. But please stick it out with us, because the world needs your light and your love, and you are worthy of being loved, and even more so, you're worthy of loving others.
Amen.
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode, where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah.
Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/Ethan Sapphire. Shoulda woulda coulda, but I didn't, that's for real. You can't get back the hand if you didn't like the deal. You made your choices, you got